everyone. It's Thursday, March 5th. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We're going to begin our show, of course, as we always do, and that is that we always do, that we must do, with the voice of Colonel Vindman testifying before Congress, reminding his father it will be all right. As I say this, not only do I think about what Colonel Vindman's words are, but I hope we'll be all right. Elizabeth Warren dropped out today, so I'm going to be kind of emotional. Anyway, a little bit of Colonel Vindman. Hear his voice. You'll be hearing it every day until November.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Again, the voice of Colonel Vindman. You'll be hearing that voice every day. Remember Vindman when you walk into the voting booth in November of 2020. I know we're going to be talking, but we have to talk about Elizabeth Warren. You were a big supporter of hers. I cried as I ultimately voted for her, thinking she didn't have necessarily the political skills or elbows that she needed, but that she had the wisdom to be a great president. And one of my students from Harvard actually put this up on Twitter. And Jamal, this is for you. I thought Elizabeth Warren was the best potential president of the bunch. She understood what was wrong with the economy, how working people get screwed, and how the real fixes that included race and gender allowed for innovation and market-based competition so more people had chances to succeed. Isn't that what the American dream is about? Giving people the chance to succeed. And Elizabeth Warren, I think, laid a foundation for it and understood what was happening with both corporate America and crony capitalism to undermine that chance. That's really what this is. She understood that.
And I think that she is going to be seen maybe 4 years from now the way Bernie was seen after 4 years ago, opening up the conversation to be able to talk mm-hmm. about these issues mm-hmm. and how our country, our economy, our politics are really fixed for the very wealthy and the big corporations, and the rest of us are losing out. And she's had that conversation. I think she would have made a fabulous president.
Well, she might be in the administration. She might, she might be the Treasury Secretary.
But I want to turn our attention a little bit to who is still in the race, because there was an article I read quoting our friend Joe Biden on the issues and saying, you know, here are the evolved policy positions that have gotten Democrats so very fired up. And it's Joe Biden on several issues. On climate change, mm-hmm. he says he'd take actions to ensure future presidents can undo progress on climate change. He says, quote, look, it's a little bit like a whole lot of things that people didn't know before this guy became president, referring to Trump, until he started to take it away. And they started to take it away. And he said, whoa, wait a minute, man. Look what that's done. He's changed the CAFE standards. We're not going to meet those standards. Well, that means boom. He's done this. It means bang. Everybody knows what he has done, and it's raised the ante significantly. Wow. No one can any longer – I remember when I introduced that bill back in 1986, they said, what the hell are you talking about, Biden? What's the crisis? Well, it wasn't – we didn't have Superstorm Sandy at the time. We didn't have all these things that are occurring that people now know and were predicted they would occur. We weren't losing species that, in fact, we find are not going to be able to – where they'll never return. I mean, there's a whole range of things. Look what's happening right now in the Amazon. The Amazon is a natural carbon sink. It absorbs emits more CO2 in the air from the air than if we took every single automobile off the road in the United States
of
America.
That's true. That's true.
That is actually his best statement
that's
here.
That's his best statement in the whole
That's
thing.
His whole environmental policy.
Right.
What's going on? Nothing. Nothing.
Yeah.
We're talking about $2 million. We should be organizing the world, demanding the change. They're the things I have done internationally. We need a diplomat in chief as well to be able to put this together. That's in my wheelhouse. I've done that my whole career.
Well,
that's
all right,
Joe Biden.
So he's not articulate.
The environment.
It's a word salad. But most of what
it
he says
– nothing also, except
it's moving in – it's better than what Trump says.
Oh, sure.
It's not even close to what Biden – I mean what Bernie or Elizabeth said. But here's my hope, okay? As we continue to prop up Joe Biden and build a moat around him so he doesn't have to talk very much in order to win. We just want to get him in there. I suspect he will be able to appoint some really fine people. Again, what did I say when we were looking at all the candidates that were running for – at what point was it 24 people were running for president? My suggestion at the time was that, well, this is our cabinet. All right? It really is our cabinet. And I think here's the good news. 99.999% of the cabinet will not be his age. 99.9% of the cabinet will be more articulate than he is. 99.9% of the cabinet will probably be more sophisticated about what needs to be done. And I think he will be pushed by the Elizabeth Warrens and by the agenda that Bernie did and the 35% of the base that supports the Bernie Sanders that understands the urgency of the moment to move. We already know Bernie changed the conversation for 2020 because he wrote that conversation in 2016. A lot of what Bernie talked about in 2016 has become part of the vernacular of 2020. If Biden wins, it'll become even more part of the vernacular because Bernie's not going away and neither is Elizabeth Warren. And frankly, the issues aren't going away. So there.
Sure. But I guess my point and some of these other things like on racial disparities and gay rights and women's issues, his view of what the issues are, we're more evolved now than we were when we were saying outright racist things in 30 years ago. And that's his view of what we need to do for racial progress.
I'm not going to look at him for word
those
guidance.
Horrors.
I'm not going to look at him. I mean, look, he's propped up. Jim Clyburn won the race, not Bernie Sanders. Not Joe Biden. This was a Clyburn race for president. Clyburn is more articulate than Joe Biden. Clyburn is more politically savvy than Joe Biden. Clyburn understood South Carolina. And you saw how he scowled behind Joe Biden, even as he was endorsing him, knowing what a lousy campaign he had, how at times inarticulate he is, how he doesn't really prepare a vision that we can even comprehend or follow. But Clyburn understood that perhaps there was a way for him to sort of hold on to this guy and carry him over the finish line. I hope Jim Clyburn is right.
Yeah, I hope so too. Look, I'm going to vote for the guy, Biden, and I hope everybody who cares about human beings, cares about the America and the world, vote for him too. All I'm saying is like his views of policy issues
are really dated
and benighted, and he's even anti things. You know, his position on health care it's not just that he opposes Medicare all.
Well, it's not even – look, I think, to be honest with you, he would probably approve the Swiss model or the German model or the French model. We talked about this all the time. There are lots of different models to get to a healthcare system that covers everyone at a price that the country can afford, let alone you can afford, that you don't go bankrupt. And frankly, what they do is they regulate insurance companies.
Yeah, but how about Wall Street? You know, the economy. He's certainly in the pocket of the very wealthy corporations. His Department of Treasury is going to be led by, you know, Goldman Sachs.
Yeah. So, all right, well, last point.
Okay.
Listen to this. I just saw something. Wall Street is now running away from the fossil fuel industry as a valid investment. There was an article that just came out and showed that they are now like overwhelmingly looking at different forms of electricity being made by so when you see the insurance industry is not insuring certain things because they believe in climate change, when you see Wall Street now beginning to degrade the fossil fuel industry as a worthwhile investment, I hate to break it to you, what's going to give Joe Biden cover is Wall Street.
Yeah, but I hate to break it to you, the free market and Wall Street, if we wait for them to react, the planet is not going to exist.
I don't disagree. We're on the same page, but at least we're all moving slowly or faster in certain direction.
Okay.
At least
it's
the right direction.
I'm going to go call Mark Stern.
I think you should. How could we not call Mark Stern? So we're going to be joined by Mark Stern very shortly, everyone. Mark Stern writes for Slate.com. He writes about the Supreme Court in particular, which is why we love him. There was an interesting Supreme Court oral argument this week that he's going to share blow by blow with. It's about abortion, so pay attention and take copious notes. And I'm about to do something for Huffington Post. They're going to do a Zoom video blog, something or other with me, about the future of Bernie and what's going to happen and what does Bernie need to do and what does how does Bernie sort of respond to what just happened on Super Tuesday. And there are a lot of interesting numbers that came out of Super Tuesday that we need to analyze, and I'm sure we'll analyze them with Bill Curry. But because we don't have Mark Stern on just yet, let me share, I think, an interesting post. Because I have been thinking a lot about and hearing a lot about people saying, you know, especially on Morning Joe, which I'm turning off. I'm getting so disgusted. But they're talking a lot about, you know, Bernie Sanders' complimentary statements about Fidel Castro, especially as they related to what Fidel was able to do with healthcare for Cubans as well as education. Not that he wasn't an authoritarian, not that he didn't kill people, not that he didn't warehouse people in prison, not that he didn't create a chilling environment in Cuba, but there were certain things that he did. Yes, healthcare got better, and yes, people got educated. I recommend that everybody should see the movie Crash, all right? Go see the movie Crash. I think it's kind of brutal sometimes, but it reminds you that people aren't all bad and all good, and that even includes despots and dictators, okay? There are a couple of things that you can notice that, oh, that wasn't bad, but the rest of you suck. So here's what I posted on Facebook, everyone, and then as soon as I finish sharing this with you, we're going to turn to Mark Stern. So the article that I was looking at was from a New York Magazine article entitled Bernie Praised Fidel Castro's Education System. So did Obama. Did you know that? Obama praised the educational system in Cuba under Fidel Castro. I'm shocked. But this is what I posted on Facebook, and then we go to Mark Stern. When Bernie spoke positively about Fidel vis-a-vis education and healthcare, remember, folks, there are no permanent allies or enemies, but there are respected policy choices, and that's not all policy choices, and common interests. So that when you say something positive about a country, it doesn't necessarily mean you embraced everything about them. And then I gave examples. You know what examples I gave, Ken? You'll love them. Think Israel, not Bibi. Think China, not Xi. Think Turkey, not Erdogan. Think Pakistan. Think India and Modi. I just want to remind you, these are people, these are countries that we on occasion have embraced because we agree with them. We find common interests. We agree with some of their policies, but under Bibi, not so much.
Have you mentioned the United States of America under Trump?
Thank you very much. And on that note, joining us right now, poor Mark Stern is going, I hope I'm not talking about this. No, you're not, but I wanted you to hear my waxing poetic before you came on, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and that's a real relief. I have avoided making any public statements about the primary and the candidates at this stage so
I don't
far,
want you
and I
to.
Don't want to stick to that.
No. I have no expectation. You're relieved of that burden. I get stuck with it because I'm doing Huffington Post this afternoon. All right, so I wish I was a little bird in that room. So tell me what happened this week at the Supreme Court, because not only do you write fabulously well, but I almost feel like I can feel the difficult breathing that must have been occurring in that space, because it must have been very acrid and very, very difficult to hear. So share with my audience the piece that you wrote. Anti-abortion advocates lied so poorly, everyone, that John Roberts may have to side with the liberals. Oh, my God. Blow me away with that headline. June Medical proves that Louisiana's law isn't about protecting women's health. Take it away, Mark Stern. I wish I were there, but I'm glad you were.
Yeah, so, I mean, this case is fascinating, right, because it's essentially a replay of a case the court heard 4 years ago, Whole Woman's Health, that involved an identical law. And this is a classic trap law, a targeted regulation of abortion providers. There is no actual desire here to improve women's health. What Texas did and what Louisiana is trying to do is force abortion clinics to close by imposing these ridiculous regulations that do nothing for patients. And so the one here is something called an admitting privileges rule, which says that in order to perform abortions in the state, you have to essentially be on the staff of a hospital within 30 miles of your clinic. And that might sound not too difficult, but the trick here is that in order to be on staff and have these privileges, you have to admit a certain number of patients a year. The hospital basically wants to be making money off of you. Mm-hmm. And if you are an abortion provider, your patients are not going to the hospital. I mean, the rate of complications with abortion is incredibly low. And so there is just no way for abortion providers to meet this standard. And they are going to have to shut their clinics if this law is upheld. And what I saw yesterday at the Supreme Court was Louisiana's Solicitor General trying and failing to convince the justices that this was actually about women's health, when it is obviously a kind of catch-22 that is setting up the clinics to fail and setting them up for closure.
So I got to start with the first question. That is, okay, so we now have precedent from 2016, I believe it was, whenever the Texas case was decided. So if we have this recent precedent, how the H to the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals actually not recognize the precedent and somehow think that they could overturn women's health? What was the rationale used by the 5th Circuit? You have the precedent. It's new. It's not old. It's relevant. It's virtually on point with everything that you're seeing in Louisiana that you saw in Texas. So where's the chutzpah, and how did they get to do it? And was it obviously only done to get it to the Supreme Court, but how do they have the justification to do it?
Right. So let's be clear. The Fifth Circuit just defied precedent.
Okay.
The Fifth Circuit just defied the Supreme Court's decision in Whole Woman's Health from 2016 and really just said, we're conservative, we don't like abortion rights, so we're not going to follow this precedent. But of course, the court had to pay lip service to that precedent. So what it said was that the admitting privileges requirement is actually beneficial in Louisiana in a way that it was not beneficial in Texas. And that what it actually did in Louisiana was provide a credentialing service for the doctors who are performing abortions. And that unlike in Texas, women would really benefit from knowing that their doctors had this extremely specific and gratuitous and arbitrary credential that allows them to be on staff at a hospital near their clinic.
I think every Texas woman should write that judge. So wait a second, what are we, chop liver? I mean, it's like somehow Louisiana women have a greater demand for credentialing than women in Texas? I mean, how could he say that? The only difference is the name of the state. Otherwise, the outcome is identical.
Yes, exactly. And to my great surprise, that is what Chief Justice John Roberts said at oral arguments
yesterday.
You're
kidding. I love it. So go on. Keep going.
I mean, I just couldn't believe that this guy hates abortion, right? Yeah. You know that John Roberts is no fan of Roe v. Wade or women's choice. But he said to Louisiana's Solicitor General, how can you claim that this law is more beneficial in one state than another? How can you claim that there's something special about Louisiana's admitting privileges rule when it is identical to Texas's, and we struck down Texas's 4 years ago? And that was this kind of like acknowledgement of reality that we do not get often from conservative Supreme Court justices, so I definitely appreciated it.
So how did they respond? I'm just kind of curious whether they said, with a straight face, when you have the chief judge basically saying, wait a minute, honey bun, this doesn't make any sense. Was there a response that was even close to cogent, or did they just raise the white flag and go, let's move on to another topic? I'm just trying to figure this out.
There was definitely no cogent response, right?
Okay.
What she tried to say, Louisiana Solicitor General Elizabeth Murrell, tried to say that, even if there was no real benefit, there was also no real burden. That, in fact, it would be super easy for doctors to get these privileges in a way that it was not easy for doctors to get these privileges in Texas. That somehow, again, the name of the state matters a great deal, and that if Louisiana doctors just tried harder, if they just worked more, then they would be able to become magically staff members of nearby hospitals in a way that Texas doctors couldn't.
Could I just add one thing? Mark, was it the Chief Justice or one of the progressive judges who asked the question, isn't it a fact that women go home first? They go home from the abortion first before they have complications, and so sending them to a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic is not going to help one bit.
Yes. that was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on fire yesterday during arguments. You know, this is very much her jam. And she kept pointing out, you know, look, Louisiana has actually already imposed a bunch of really stringent regulations on abortion clinics, FYI. There used to be 11 clinics in the state, and now there are only 3. And so women are already driving hours and hours and hundreds of miles to get an abortion in the state. So why would they go to a hospital within 30 miles of the clinic when in virtually every single case, they are going home after the procedure? And in fact, 40% of them aren't even getting a procedure. They are getting the abortion pills, and they are driving home before they take them.
And let me just read a sentence from your fabulous article at Slate.com. We should all become, you know, followers of Mark Joseph Stern. Abortion providers will never qualify because their patients don't go to hospitals. Merle claimed that no one knows the actual complication rate of abortions, leading Kagan to correct her with a fact. Oh, my God, with a fact. From the record, facts. My God, tisk, tisk. Listen to this. One clinic has served around 70,000 women over 23 years and has transferred only, ready for this, everyone, 4 patients ever to a hospital. Now, I don't know about you, but I would never make that doctor an admitting physician if it's only 4 over 23 years. They don't make any money on that physician.
Yes, exactly right. And you know, Louisiana's Solicitor General kept trying to say, oh, well, we don't really know how many women, you know, this clinic has transferred to hospitals. We don't really know that number. And Justice Kagan just looked so irritated because she was essentially holding up the record and saying, we do know. This is not a mystery. You know, we have facts. We have reality-based facts in this case. And so we can actually say with certainty that these clinics are not transferring patients to the hospital because abortion is extremely safe and extremely easy, and women are just not suffering complications frequently enough for any hospital to admit these doctors to their staff.
So can I sue Merle? And the reason why I want to sue Merle is she this is incredible. I think that the record shows that they can get privileges, Merle objected. She accused the doctors of having sabotaged their own applications. Excuse me. Are you accusing my integrity? Are you suggesting that I would sabotage an application to a hospital? I want to sue the pants off of you, lady, because that's hurting my reputation in the community. I cannot believe the stuff that she was saying.
It's so absurd, and I think it's important to note that the way this case played out, actually, the federal judge who eventually ruled against this law and blocked it was skeptical that the law was unconstitutional and actually supervised the doctors for more than a year while they tried to get these admitting privileges. The judge basically said, prove to me that you can't get these admitting privileges, and that's exactly what the doctors did. They applied, they tried to get these privileges, they talked to nearby hospitals, and every single hospital said the same thing, which was, this just isn't the kind of thing that we're allowed to give to you.
Can we make this into a mini-series? I swear, you know, in a way, it has everything everybody loves, you know what I mean? It's just, when you see this played out and you realize what it's doing to women and what it's doing to women's lives and how this is not about their health and safety, this is about their, you know, ideological agenda and to hell with women, I think women need, I mean, reading this story, hearing you tell it is so empowering and it's so aggravating because once again, I feel like I'm a pawn in a chess game. I'm not a life. I'm not someone to be respected. It is so outrageous, Mark.
And not just a miniseries, but Mark, do you think that the brazenness of these lies and the obviousness that Justice Roberts is calling them on it, do you think that that is going to affect future cases where maybe the lies are less brazen and less obvious, but it's clearly an excuse to restrict women's right to an abortion?
Well, you know, this case has some similarities to the census case where the Trump administration tried to put a citizenship question on the upcoming census and just lied top to bottom about its reasons for doing so, just would not tell the truth in court. And Chief Justice Roberts ruled against the administration, and what he said in his opinion, which was quite remarkable, was basically lie better next time. time. You know, I am sympathetic to your desires here, but you have not given me a good enough reason to rule in your favor. And I felt that that was his attitude in this case. You know, I would overturn Roe v. Wade if you asked me to, maybe. You know, I would definitely cut back on a woman's right to choose. But I am not going to humiliate myself in this court by pretending to believe the nonsense that you've brought to me.
There's an expression that I used to use with my children, only they would hear a bad word. And so I would say my SHIT detector is going off. and because when I would start like making believe I was shoveling as I was listening to him going, you know, come back to me and talk to me, but don't do this. And I feel like that's exactly what Justice Roberts probably was suggesting, was that, you know, I may be predisposed in a certain direction, but what I'm not predisposed is if you offer me lies for that direction, then you're not getting there. There's a bridge to this, and the bridge are based on facts and reality, not based on stuff that you're making up and pulling out of your socks. So it's just unbelievable. I only have 1 minute left, but in that 1 minute, I want you to also just quickly tell us, the Supreme Court is at its most divided. You can just give us a statistic, again, a number that will make people understand that what we are seeing in the country is being mirrored on the bench.
Yeah, this is the first time in more than 10 years that the court has issued three decisions divided 5-4 along partisan lines this early in the term. And these were important decisions about capital punishment, right, about immigration, about the ability of victims of Border Patrol to sue in court when their human rights are violated. And the conservative bloc is throwing around its weight on this court in a way that it has not in a very long time, and it should disturb us all, because usually at this point that the justices are still trying to compromise, to make concessions, to find middle ground, and increasingly it looks like the conservative justices are willing to just count to five and issue whatever decision they want because they have the votes.
So is it that the conservatives are willing to do it, or is it that the liberals are not willing to sort of keep narrow focusing, at least giving some kind of protection so that the decisions aren't so broad in scope but more narrow in scope? Or is it that the conservative justices are just basically saying, don't even try?
Well, the libs have to convince one conservative justice. They had Kennedy as the one that they could convince this is going too far, and he narrowed
the decision. But you would assume that Roberts might be willing to more narrow cast as opposed to broadcast. And that's what's frustrating.
I think Justice Elena Kagan would do that if she could. Right. And she's done it in the past, and she's sometimes convinced Roberts to go along. But I just don't see it happening this term. I think she is still trying.
Okay.
I think she is very strategic and flexible, but I don't see the conservatives going along, because all three of these decisions that were 5-4, they could have been sort of broadened out to a unanimous decision that avoided the big issue, or at least a kind of lopsided vote that drew a lot of justices to a centrist position. And instead, the conservative bloc just went all the way each time.
Right. It's my ball game. I own it.
Yeah.
Mark Joseph Stern, fabulous writer, covers the courts and the law for Slate.com. Go to Slate.com, and as soon as you see his name, read that article. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
All right. Ciao. Here we go, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And, of course, this is the day that Elizabeth Warren has left the race.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day auto workers at GM's Chevy Vega plant in Lordstown, Ohio, walked out on strike. The strike lasted for 18 days. The issues that fueled it were reminiscent of the sit-downs and wildcats that built the UAW in the 30s and 40s. Workers at Lordstown wanted greater control over the production process. The young, integrated workforce of the 1960s social protest era was fed up with long days, forced overtime, increased automation, and dangerous speed-up on the assembly line. Long-standing grievances numbered in the thousands, and disciplinary firings were common. Absenteeism was rampant. Morale was so low that cars left the assembly line incomplete or vandalized. By the time the strike ended, many felt it was called simply to allow workers to blow off steam. There was no real change in the production process, but jobs eliminated in the 1970 contract were restored, and some 1,400 disciplinary layoffs were dropped. The worker malaise suffered there came to be known as the Lordstown Syndrome. In his book, Staying Alive, the 1970s and the Last Days of the Working Class, Jefferson Cowie notes that the strike compelled the Senate to hold hearings on alienation at work. its committee produced the report Work in America. This report confirmed many workers at all occupational levels feel locked in. Their mobility blocked, the opportunity to grow lacking in their jobs, challenge missing from their tasks. Cowie concludes that the strike and report initiated the quality of work-life movement that sought to redesign work, introduce automation differently, and invest in human relations strategies, most of which continued to empower management, not workers, albeit with a gentler hand.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. And this is Climate Connections. Composer Stephen Bryan of Durham, North Carolina, is worried about global warming, and he's expressing his anxiety through a recent composition.
It's not a piece of music that describes the environment degrading. It's more of my own psychological journey of wrestling with this.
The Automatic Earth is a 30-minute piece for wind ensemble and electronic sounds.
A lot of these sounds, the electronic ones in particular, have a very ominous quality to them.
At times, the music becomes loud and discordant. At the piece's climax, bright lights shine down on the audience.
Sort of putting the audience and the listener in the spotlight and turning the attention away from the stage and onto all of us. It's a confrontational piece of music.
Through it, Bryant hopes to make the climate crisis impossible to ignore.
For 30 minutes, you have to think about it. You have no choice.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
A hurry brings you down. The news they sell you to put in your mind that all mankind is a failure.
There is no savior. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. The name of the song is What Happens Tomorrow. It is sung by
Duran Duran.
So before I bring up my guest, let me share with you a statement on Facebook from a friend of mine. Ron Abramson is a regular voice on this radio show. He's an immigration lawyer, one of the most thoughtful people I have ever met. He is also one of the most articulate people I've ever met. The first time I met Ron was when he was endorsing Bernie Sanders in 2015. He then, over the course of time, ended up realizing that Elizabeth Warren was his choice for 2020. When he endorsed Bernie Sanders, he spoke better than Bernie or any Bernie supporter I'd ever heard in my life, and I went, who is this guy? When he brought Elizabeth Warren to New Hampshire back at the end of 2019 and had an event for her, we also heard him speak, and we were all like, oh, my God, he spoke better than any Elizabeth Warren supporter or even Elizabeth himself. So clearly, his ability to articulate a message and to convey a feeling is remarkable. But here is what Ron Abramson said today as Elizabeth Warren announces she's leaving the race. I'm having a hard time accepting that Elizabeth Warren is ending her campaign for president. I feel sad for her devoted staff and volunteers, for women of all ages, and for the fact that due to a myriad of influences, many of which would be the subject of her proposed reforms, she didn't get the traction and consideration her candidacy objectively deserved. I'm taking a brief political respite, but yes, I'm blue no matter who, and then figure out where I'll focus my activist energy in the future. Ron Abramson, a fabulous voice. Anyone who gets him to support you knows that you've gotten something real and valuable. Joining us right now is someone real and valuable that I always appreciate and didn't realize when I contacted him at the beginning of the week. I thought we'd only be talking about sort of what happened on Super Tuesday. And now I realize that not only did we see so many people leave the race before Super Tuesday, but since Super Tuesday, we've seen two very, very different people leave the race. A gazillionaire named Michael Bloomberg, who now says he'll put his billions behind Joe Biden, and Elizabeth Warren, who challenged Michael Bloomberg. And if anybody sort of hurt his campaign more than anyone else single-handedly, it was that woman named Elizabeth Warren. Joining me right now is Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for governor of Connecticut twice, was an advisor to Bill Clinton, writes for Salon.com, an incredibly articulate and honest and interesting individual when it comes to sort of helping us look at the tea leaves of politics. Welcome to the program, Bill Curry.
Great to be with you, as always.
All right.
And, cheer up.
I'm perky.
These are the hard days. I get it.
Yeah, I know.
Boy, oh boy. And we've both lived through this, but which makes us two of the people who should be telling everyone around us to bug up a little bit here.
Right,
because
we've survived. We've survived. And to some extent thrived in a different arena, but we've survived, and losing is not easy. And walking away is not easy. But you also have to look at what you've accomplished. And you can clearly say Elizabeth Warren has accomplished a lot, and not just as a U.S. senator, not just with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but with the policies that she laid out that I think also are a roadmap for a lot of the candidates that are running now and perhaps the next president of the United States.
I don't doubt that for a second.
Right. Yeah, me too. So where do you want to start? Do you want to go from the most recent, or do you want to go to Clyburn and South Carolina? How do you want to take a look as we sort of look at this very, very frenetic, confusing, changing week where a lot of expectations were not met and some expectations that we were shocked by were far exceeded?
Well, you know, let me say, let me just offer a couple of ideas, and then you take it where you think you'd like to go. But the first thing I just want to say is it's a dark morning for progressives within the Democratic Party in particular. But this isn't over, and one of the things about politics is that it's chock full of optical illusions, and they're so easy to be taken in by.
Exactly.
And I'd like to see the next Biden-Sanders debate.
Oh, me too.
Or rather, the first Biden-Sanders debate as well. And I'd like to let this settle out. I'm not in denial about this. I think that there's no question that Joe Biden is the likely nominee of the Democratic Party.
Of course.
And I understand that everybody I see on cable television has long said that if only the moderates would get out of the race, then Biden would win overwhelmingly. And he had a big day on Tuesday to back them up.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see how this settles out over the next few days, and I'd like to see how that choice clarifies.
Mm-hmm.
If next Tuesday is the same as last Tuesday, then it's all the more likely that this will have the earliest nominee in a contested Democratic presidential race, primary race, that I can recall.
Mm-hmm.
This could be functionally over in a couple of weeks in terms of determining the nominee. I get that. But it isn't right now. One of the things I'm looking to see is what Elizabeth Warren does now. She's getting out today. It will say a great deal about her underlying views. If she chooses not to endorse anyone, as she did in 2016, if she chooses to endorse Joe Biden because that's where the game's going, or if she decides that the Democratic Party still needs a deep, fundamental debate over some core issues.
So what do you recommend, my friend Bill Curry? Because I see value in either one. I see value in perhaps influencing the next nominee, Joe Biden, and that maybe you have a better chance of influencing him and maybe moving some of his policy agendas in a way that are more progressive. I also see influence with her if she meets and decides to support Bernie Sanders, because in the end, it's a conversation that still needs to be had and shouldn't be over too soon, because if it's over too soon, it might be forgotten. And God forbid that happens.
And again, I'll just say this. I'll be in the best mood if she endorses Bernie Sanders. And I don't. I've never thought that primaries had to be destructive. I've always thought the Democratic Party needed more discussion of its first premises and core convictions than it usually indulges in. If it weren't for Bernie Sanders, we might have gone on as we did through the entire Obama era, with progressives silent when the party chose not to raise the minimum wage, chose behind closed doors to kill the public options, chose to completely abandon the anti-corporate corruption agenda that was the main theme of Obama's general election campaign. I'll stop, but there are many, you know, there are lots of times when the Obama administration went radio silent on climate change in its first term, which it did.
Thank you. I know.
But we should have spoken up. Et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think that those debates hurt. You have to have them in a careful way. You have to have them in a way that doesn't over-personalize these differences. But you also have to have them in a way that flushes them out. And Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 for lots of reasons, and I don't pretend to know the ultimate truth of that election. And Putin and Comey and the Electoral College and sexism, all those things played a role. She also completely abandoned the Bernie Sanders message. She treated the progressive establishment as a speed bump on the way to the nomination to be left behind as soon as she had the convention in her rearview mirror. And I think that I think if she hadn't done that, she'd have won despite all those other things.
What states didn't she go to?
Well, even if she'd gone to Wisconsin, she still would have lost the election.
No. But in a way, it's not even – it's what that meant.
That's right.
It's symbolic.
But the main thing is – let me say, I challenge it a little bit because there's a tendency of the pundits I see on television to talk about all these things in terms of tactics. And I believe that we, even progressives, continue to underestimate the power of ideas. And I know the establishment party does. Some of the good news of the last few days is, one, that the guy with the most money, Bernie Sanders, raised all of it virtually in small contributions. Two, that the guy with the guy with the most money, yeah, as an anomaly, Michael Bloomberg, didn't get anything out of it.
Right.
And three, I'm happy to know that on one level that Biden won five states in which he didn't spend a penny.
Well, I know
there was other money spent, but he was basically – the guy who got outspent the worst was Biden. He won everything. The guy who had the most money from outside the party
everything.
Was Bloomberg.
Right, and he lost everything except for American Samoa.
It does – these things – I've been arguing to people for a long time that the price Democrats have paid for mortgaging themselves to their donor class, the loss of the clarity and power of the message, the ineffectiveness of their agenda – the apparent ineffectiveness of it has undercut them enormously. And being able to make the argument that we can have a small donor-driven party, that we can put this behind, you can make this argument, as I have, based on the results of all the last presidential elections going back to 1996. At the presidential level, for sure, money doesn't so much tip the scales to one candidate or another as it mortgages both candidates to the economic status quo and thus to the past. And that's why we trail the world in converting from fossil fuels to renewables and from for-profit insurance to universal health care. It is precisely because we are mortgaged in that way, because our quote-unquote progressive party, my party, the Democratic Party, is too mortgaged to big money. One of the hardest things to watch in the last few days has been the liberal media's continued treatment of Sanders on two levels. One, Pete Buttigieg lost a lot of credibility with me over the course of this campaign, But his Ivy League red baiting of Bernie Sanders over the simple observation that Cuba, one of the most impoverished nations in our hemisphere, has a higher literacy rate than the United States, the richest nation in the world.
Right.
I'd like Americans to know that. I think that gives us something to ponder.
So you did not hear this, but how I began my show this half hour was I mentioned how Bernie praised Fidel Castro's education system. So did Barack Obama.
I don't know if I've ever talked about this show, but I spent some time in Cuba. I actually met with Castro. I spent 10 hours with him once many, many years ago. And I know that if I lived there, I'd probably be in jail because I'm a natural-born dissenter.
Right.
But I also know that they have universal child care. They have universal health care.
I know.
They don't have the best high-tech health care, far from it. But they have the best day-to-day health care because you can get it without going bankrupt. They have the lowest crime rates, lower addiction rates. I know what it's like to walk around in a city that has socioeconomic problems. I grew up in one. And when you walk around Havana, you can tell it's a different feel on the streets. And those are things we should understand.
And
to say it does not for one moment deny our objections to the political system.
So what? This is why you're going to love, because we are like twins. So what I just posted on Facebook this morning was not only that article, but I wrote the following, and I'm going to say it again and read it again out loud to my audience. When Bernie spoke positively about Fidel vis-a-vis education and health care, remember, folks, there are no permanent allies or enemies, but there are respected policy choices, and that's not all policy choices, and there are common interests. Think Israel. Think China. Think Turkey. Think Pakistan. Think India. I mean, let's be honest here.
And as Ken added to you this morning, think the United States of America under Donald Trump.
Exactly. And what's more important is you were saying that. What I think that I always tell people, you should see the movie Crash. The movie Crash is really edifying because nobody is all good and nobody is all bad.
Mm-hmm.
We can value the good and we can be disgusted with the bad. But that's also true. How did Cuba provide health care for everyone and we did not?
Coincidentally, it was Castro who once wrote, I heard him say, people are never the enemy. Only systems are the enemy.
Wow.
Which is an extraordinary insight. And I think it's the first time I've quoted that line and attributed it to him.
Well, I'm so glad
it's so
I inspired
hard to explain.
It.
And I'll just finish with this, though, okay? And that is that, one, I've had to answer to three or four people asking me, why does Bernie keep bringing up Castro? And if Bernie doesn't keep bringing up Castro, Anderson Cooper did.
Yeah.
I wish Bernie were a more dexterous debater and interview subject than he is. And I do want to say that I really believe that I don't want to lose track of the fact that we, in fact, have an agenda which is mostly ready for prime time, and which, on issue after issue, the public already embraces.
Right.
But I don't want to do what the establishment did of 2016. Hillary Clinton has spent the last 4 years blaming the progressives for her loss. And it's just a terrible. The Clintons are one of the worst aspects of the Clintons is they never take responsibility for their own misdeeds ever. It's almost Trumpian. But I don't want to make that mistake as a progressive. I don't want to sit around blaming the Clinton Party for our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I think we've made them.
I think there's
things we can have. The good news here is we are so close to a politics. In both in terms of a demography, there'll be 25 million new voters in 2024. The only democratizing influence of the internet has been that it's made small donor funded campaigns possible.
Mm-hmm.
That the only democratizing influence that I can see, and that those things bode well for us. And the country is already, even without the new voters and the change, they're with us on almost all these issues.
Right,
but. I was speaking to a group of liberals in Connecticut on election night, and I just said, you know, there were a lot of state reps and activists and local officials in the room, and it was a drinking liberal chapel, and a lot of people, mostly progressives, and I just said, listen, every one of you knows that when you went door to door, you had to answer a certain set of questions, and you had to reassure people, no matter how progressive you are, you know that there are three questions that are sort of conservative tending that we all have to answer to the satisfaction of voters. Well, one is, how much does that cost? The second is, does that really work? Mm-hmm. And the third is, will you keep me safe?
Exactly.
And we have good answers to these.
Right.
But I honestly believe that the fiscal bidding war, that Bernie and Warren got into, was to the detriment of each. There's been an argument in the media, do people really want big change or revolution or incrementalism? And it turns out they really want incrementalism. No, it doesn't. They really do want big radical change. They're that angry, they're that desperate, and they see that clearly. It doesn't mean they want a big bureaucracy imposed on them that you haven't built yet. It doesn't mean that they don't want clear answers. It doesn't mean that they're not skittish. All of us on the left have at different times called ourselves progressives or populists. It would behoove us, I believe that in my heart, to go back and read some of the literature, the history of the actual progressive and populist movements who wanted profound structural change, a thoroughgoing integrity, who wanted to take on the powerful at every turn, and use the power of government to counterbalance the power of the wealthy. And they were also very frugal. You can't find any proposals to increase spending in any of their platforms. Yes. I've read them.
So answer
And that's
question.
The point for us to just stop and say, so what are we saying to people? We, if we make sure we answer those questions, then we can have a living wage. And by the way, they don't mind taxing the rich. We can have a wealth tax and a Wall Street transactions tax, and we can restore the personal income rates of the Obama or Clinton years, and we can raise the corporate rates. We can get enough money to do the job, and the public's for it. But we have to. They have to be reassured, really reassured, that we aren't just picking their pockets, and that we know what we're doing. And I don't think we. I don't think we spend enough time. Nearly enough time doing that.
So you know
that's the price of admission.
So your fiscal bidding war is so interesting to me. There's a couple of things that are running through my head. I remember when I was running on an income tax in New Hampshire, talking to a group of conservative men, and this is the highest compliment I think I've ever gotten, Bill. They trusted me. They said it makes sense. You're not asking for more from me. You're kind of rearranging the deck chairs in a way that I will be protected from high property taxes that are eating 25% of my income. You will not expect me to pay a total tax bill of more than maybe 10%. I see who will now pay, those that clearly can come. And here was the concern. Listen to this. It wasn't that they didn't trust me and understood that I wasn't asking for more, but that I was using the amount efficiently and effectively without harming them. And what they said was, we're just afraid that you will have opened a new door and someone will then abuse it. So they were looking ahead, not at me. Me they trusted. And remember what I said to them, Bill? I said to them this. I said, so why should I be the first politician you trust? Maybe we can create a pattern and practice going forward. I shouldn't be a one-off. I should be the kind of people you can rely on because they are honest with you. They understand your fear because it's legitimate. And because they also understand this is not about check writing. It's about effective government.
Well, when I was a very young state senator in Connecticut a million years ago, I introduced the first plant closings notification bill. And the first to pass a legislative chamber, we passed it in the state senate and lost by a vote in the house. And when we were doing it, the local chambers of commerce in two towns, Simsbury, a very Republican conservative town, and the other was Groton, a more mixed democratically town. But the chambers of commerce in both towns endorsed the bill.
Exactly.
Because they got that it was in their interest and that their interests weren't simultaneous with the interests of the biggest global players.
Right.
And they were told that if they didn't rescind their endorsements, they could no longer be a part of the state chamber. So they did. But it was an interesting moment. And I just want to say again that our progressivism has always been more anarchist than syndicalist. Mm-hmm. It's always been about keeping everything small from being devoured by everything big.
Right.
Our ultimate progressive coalition will include small businesses and family farmers.
Right.
And on the day that it does, we can rule for a generation. And so, and it doesn't require any compromises with the pharmaceutical industry, the for-profit insurance industry, mm-hmm. the military-industrial complex, fossil fuels. It requires compromises with voters, and it requires that, and by that I mean answering their legitimate concerns. And the last thing, if I can just take 30 seconds, it also means I've been stunned, just horrified at the performance of the establishment media in this. It's worse even than the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. The red baiting of Bernie and the Cuba stuff, the contempt, the open, derisive contempt for the principal theme of Bernie's, both Bernie's campaigns, that corporate corruption is what's keeping us from making social progress taken for granted in every other country. Mm-hmm. They act as if it isn't true. You know, if they're bored of hearing him say it, I'm bored of never hearing them say it.
No, I have 2 minutes. So I'm going to just remind everyone, as you were talking, they did exit interviews with the voters on Super Tuesday, and by a significant majority, they supported Medicare for All as they voted for Joe Biden. I just want people to hear that. Just listen to this.
They do. And again, in my opinion, there's a transition proposal which I've made, which is between the public option proposals and that we can do. We can meet people's legitimate concerns and get to universal health care. We could do it in year one.
But the reason I'm saying this is that this also is thematic because you mentioned something else about the idea of what voters want and what politicians are talking to. In Massachusetts, not one single politician supported the concept of decriminalization or the legalization of marijuana, but it won in every single town except for maybe two.
That's been the story of our lives.
Exactly. And when we increased the minimum wage by referendum, where every single politician in red states opposed it, it passed. So I just want people to know that when you actually look at the policies of a Bernie Sanders, for example, or an Elizabeth Warren, when people actually hear those policies, their base, their supporters, their Democratic voters, that's what they want.
And another call will go into more of this, but seeing how all of these things are refracted to us through what is corporate media, the reason the corporate media don't like hearing the corporate corruption theme is that they're corporate media.
Exactly, they're corporate media.
See things. One of the things we learned this year is that Joe Biden is actually a grouchier person than Bernie. of the two, he's the grouchier old man. Bernie shouts about billionaires. Biden shouts at voters. Everything I know about politics says that's got to be worse.
And on that note, I need to let you go. I need to let you go. Bill Curry, we need you for an hour. Thank you so much for joining us. And I've got a smile on my face, which I didn't have at the beginning of the show. So thank you so much. Ciao.
See you guys.
Bye-bye. And we end with?
We end with an ode to Elizabeth Warren by Gladys Knight and the Pips. Neither one of us wants to say goodbye, and breaks my heart to play it.
Making me cry. Don't do this.